Mayor and Town Council are Peyton Mahaffey, Lawrence J. McClafferty, Autumn P. McCullough, Accolade Council.
Viv, you are a court reporter, correct?
Yes.
I need to inquire of you whether or not you are using a machine that simultaneously has audio recording.
Yes, sir.
Well, we don't...
Turn it off.
Yes. All right, you may proceed.
My name is James Moore. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, William J. Riney, curator of the estate of Frank Still. We're here asking the Court of Appeal to reverse summary judgment that was entered for the defendants below, Laverne Lemon and Jeffrey Still, finding that they breached no fiduciary duty to their father, the decedent, Frank Still. We're asking the court to reverse the summary judgment, finding no breach, and to, in fact, find, as a matter of law, there was a breach. As a result, we would ask the court to send the case back only on the issue of damages and imposition of constructive trust. There will be no issues, we believe, for trial regarding the merits of the question of whether there was a breach of fiduciary duty. Frank Still's original trust, which was executed in 1991 and amended in 1999, provided very simply that if his wife survived him, she would have the benefit of all of his assets for her lifetime. Significantly, it provided that at the end of her life, if she survived, she could, by will, appoint the remainder of his trust to anyone, any entity, any charity she chose. And if it third provided that if she did not survive it, or she survived but didn't exercise the power of appointment, that she could, that 45% would go to his two children, Laverne Lemon and Jeffrey Still, and 55% would go to Jane, his wife's family, which included Mr. Reinick and others, 10 others. Jane died first. She did not survive Frank. Frank survived but was incompetent or incapacitated. And Laverne Lemon, his daughter, took over as Jane's, replaced Jane as the attorney in fact, Frank. Laverne Lemon and her brother, Jeffrey, still took over as co-trustees of Frank's trust. On February 27, 2012, the day before Frank died in Florida, Laverne Lemon and her brother executed a new trust called the Still Living Trust that they created. Laverne Lemon created it as under her authority as power of attorney. She and her brother executed it and accepted it as co-trustees. That trust, instead of giving 55% to Jane's relatives and 45% to themselves, gave all of the assets to Lemon and Still. Now, in spite of this obvious self-dealing conduct by Lemon and Still, the trial court found, as a matter of law, at summary judgment, that they had breached no fiduciary duty to their father. To reach that conclusion, the trial court would have had to find two things. First, it would have to find, as a matter of law, that Frank's power of attorney authorized the creation of the trust that Ms. Lemon created. For reasons I'll state in a moment, we believe it did not do so. Secondly, even if the power of attorney did allow the creation of the trust that was created, the exercise of that power had to be done in the best interest of the principal, Frank, consistent with his reasonable expectations. That requirement arises from two places. Article 8 of the power of attorney itself requires any act to be in the interest of Frank. And Uniform Power of Attorney Act, which Virginia has adopted, requires the same thing. First, it's clear on the face of the trust that was created that it does not comply with the authority under Article 5, Section F of the Power of Attorney. That allows the creation of trusts that will benefit Frank during his lifetime. They must also benefit his wife and his descendants, Lemon and Still, after his lifetime. The trust that was created, but still a living trust, does not benefit Jane. It benefits his wife. It only benefits Lemon and Still.
I don't understand your argument. Jane is deceased.
That's correct.
And so Jane is no longer a factor in this equation. If your argument is correct, if Jane is deceased, you're arguing they could never change the trust because she's deceased?
That's correct. And the language of the trust, everyone agrees it's unambiguous. So do the appellees. And it says wife and descendant. If, as they suggest, that after Jane died it should be read to mean wife and or descendants, or wife or descendants, it was easy enough to do that. And or is used in the clause immediately preceding the words wife and descendants. The drafter of this document knew how to use those words and distinguished what he meant by saying and or in one place and or in the other. One final point on that, and that is the Uniform Power of Attorney Act creates the power to create a trust through an attorney, in fact, as a special limited power. The Act says no attorney, in fact, shall create a trust on behalf of his principal unless it is expressly authorized. The trust that was created here was not expressly authorized.
Well, now, you don't dispute they have the power to create an inter vivos trust. You're
That's
just saying it would have to be a different
trust
type
that
of
was created was not authorized. The power was there. Now,
can I pause you for a second to make sure I understood that last point? This is a durable power of attorney. It has a global authorization clause.
Right.
Do and perform anything the attorney, in fact, may deem advisable, anything of any character that I might do or perform on for myself. That's seemingly unlimited.
It's limited. That's Article 2, I believe you're reading from.
Article 2, yes.
Yes, and it says, provided that it complies with the law, and the other provisions of this power of attorney. Those are the limitations, including the power of attorney.
So the limitation here is the absence of and or in Article 5F? That's a very subtle limitation to a very broad grant of power.
No, it's excuse me, the limitation is 1622A1, which is part of the Power of Attorney Act. It says, you shall not, as an attorney in fact, create a trust unless it's expressly authorized.
So just saying you can do anything that I could do is not an express authorization?
No, because it's limited by the law, which is the Uniform Power of Attorney Act, and the other provisions of the power of attorney itself.
But then doesn't it still just go back to your interpretation of what the power of attorney document says in Article 5?
Yes, and that is it says wife and, not wife or. Now, even if the court disagrees with us on that point, we don't think it should, the reversal of the summary judgment is required here because the second requirement, even if you have the power to act, it has to be done consistent with the expectations of the principal and consistent with the principal's interest. That's part of the attorney. In fact, power of attorney is required in Article 8, Section G. And also under the Act, the Uniform Act. There were no undisputed facts at summary judgment that would show a benefit to Frank. This trust was created on the day before he died in anticipation of his death. It provided no new benefits or different benefits for Frank if he had survived. It was identical to his trust with respect to him, his original trust. And it was contrary to his testamentary intent shown by his original trust to give 50.
Well, we don't know that.
Oh, his
because you know, these were on parallel tracks, Jane and Frank, and Jane's dispositions were changed why isn't it reasonable for the trustee to conclude, well, that affects the whole thing?
Because Frank's testamentary intent can only be determined by looking at his trust. This court said in the Keith versus Lulof case and the chain of cases before that, when you look to the testator's intent, he can't have any interest or expectation regarding another person's trust or will unless he has an agreement that that person won't change their trust. In this situation, there was no agreement between the parties, written or otherwise. There's an allegation of an unwritten agreement, but there's no undisputed fact at summary judgment that such an agreement existed. The only fact he could point to that even suggested is the parallel trusts themselves. And this court said in Lulof's, the existence of parallel trust does not establish an agreement. Absent that, Frank had no expectation regarding what his wife's trust would do.
When we're looking at intent, can we do we have to focus laser-like on this older document, or can we look at the newer document also?
Which newer
document? Which is the durable power of attorney, to inform what his overall intent was.
I think regarding the disposition of his trust and any relationship with his wife's trust, we have to look at the two trusts that were done in 1991 and modified in 99. And there is no suggestion. Frank gave her the power to dispose of his entire trust, and there would have been no remainder for Levin and Spivey. So it's clear that he never intended to safeguard or ensure for his children 45% of his trust, much less her trust, which under Lulof's, he has no expectation.
Unless under the durable power of attorney, he did just that.
There's nothing in the act itself, or excuse me, in the power of attorney that suggests that he did.
Can I take you back to this language because I'm confused by the exchange you just had? Article 2 says that the power of attorney may do anything, the attorney in fact may do anything that the attorney in fact may deem advisable. Anything of any character that I, Frank, might, not would, not have at trial and figure out if I was going to or any of that. So, I mean, just the literal language suggests to me that the power of attorney is as broad as you can possibly write it. You do what you think is right. And if it's something that I might have done, fine. No trial, good enough. So it's a really broad boundary. Seems
it has a limiting clause at the end, Your Honor. It says, but excluding those matters which my attorney, in fact, is not permitted to do as expressly provided in this power of attorney.
Okay, pause right there. Where does it say somewhere else that he couldn't do that? Where else does it say in the power of attorney that this could not be done?
Article 8, Section G says he must exercise, he or she, the attorney, in fact, must exercise any power consistent with Frank's reasonable interests and expectations.
Well, he stated his interest in his expectation in Article 2, which is you can do anything you think is fair if you think that I might do it.
If the law permits it. And what we're suggesting here is the law does not permit it. The court could never find that Frank, we believe, had an expectation that his wife and his trust would be divided 45-55 because he had no expectation regarding what she would do under her trust unless there's an agreement. The power of attorney, the power of appointment that he gave her refutes any argument that he ever intended to ensure that she and he gave 45% of their assets because he gave her the absolute power if she survived to dispose of all of his assets as power she would. So he didn't even reserve his 45%, much less hers. Under this case, it's the court's decisions. The testator has no control over anyone's assets other than his own unless he has an agreement proved by clear and satisfactory evidence. At summary judgment, there was no such evidence before this court. The court should reverse. Regarding the fees, and we suggest there's no need to remand on that issue of breach of fiduciary duty because the power of appointment that Frank gave her excludes any possibility they can prove an agreement or an expectation that 45% of both trusts were reserved for these children. On the fees, I'm going to stand on our brief except to say this. The statute is clear. The only authority for fees in this case was the statute involved, 64.2795, and it authorized fees to be awarded for one party against another party. Mr. Ryan was not a party to this litigation. He was individual. Nevertheless, the court awarded $650,000 in fees against an individual.
There is a flavor in the cases cited by your opponent that when a person acts for their individual benefit, they put on an executor cap or a curator cap, but they're clearly acting for their individual benefit. While the cases don't clearly say it, the intent of the cases seems to be that they would do a sort of piercing of the corporate veil where they would look behind the cap and determine who is actually appearing before the court, and in that individual capacity, arguably would treat them as a party. Why isn't that a fair read of the Clark case and the line of cases they cite?
Two things. First, in the first litigation between these parties, Ryan Inc. and 10 other individual trust beneficiaries asserted claims based on the same conduct of challenging this. The court below, as a matter of law, held they didn't have standing and that they could not be before the court making those claims. Reinick then got appointed curator to bring the claims on behalf of the estate. He was there in his official capacity or in his representative capacity, not his individual. And as a matter of law, he could not be before the court to be the object of any fee award. That's number one. Number two is the cases that they cite are totally different situations. They're cases where a fiduciary tried to recover his fees from the estate or a trust, even though the court determined he was acting for his own benefit.
Which normally he would be allowed to do, but for the fact he was progressing his own interest.
But even if you assume that Mr. Browning only is pursuing his own interest, which we dispute, but let's assume that, he's not asking for his fees to be paid by the trust or the estate. It's Ms. Lemon who is
right, I understand the difference in that.
She's trying to impose her fees on him as an individual, and he wasn't a party before the court to be the object of such an obligation.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Peyton Mahaffey, I have the honor of representing Laverne Lemon, the appellee in the case. And before I forget something that I've written in our briefs, anything that I neglect to respond to with respect to questions that you might have or that I might say, I would rely on the briefs that we filed. In listening to the appellant's argument, he doesn't address the obvious. The court was plainly looking at the authority of the power of attorney when it granted the summary judgment. Article 5, Section F of the power of attorney could not be a clearer authority. And there is, you know, the ability to create, as though it were Frank himself, inter vivos trust, whether revocable or irrevocable, for my benefit during my lifetime and or the benefit of my wife and my descendants after my death could not be any clearer. So the power of attorney authorizes the creation of the living trust. And then the question is that power of attorney is that authority outside? And the appellant has argued that it's outside of the authority because he didn't leave the living trust, Mrs. Lemon, as acting as agent for Frank, really acting as Frank, that Mrs. Lemon did not provide for Jane Still, who had been dead. So to provide for a dead person, somehow, if to accept that reasoning, would then say that the power of attorney, that grant, is nullified. You cannot provide for my my descendants because my wife is dead. It doesn't say that. And the petition for appeal and the two briefs filed subsequently by the appellant hold on to that and argument. And the and argument makes no sense. Because if you just look at the other provisions of the power of attorney, and I'll try to be quick with this, look at Article 3, Section J. The power to make gifts of my real property or personal property or my interest in such property to my wife and my children and my grandchildren. That illustrates the point. If there are no grandchildren, then there can be no gift of property to my wife or my children. If there are no children, there can be no gift to my wife or my grandchildren. The best example, really the one that puts the lie to the whole construction that there was no authority here, is in Article 4, in the specific powers under the power of attorney, under support. There, the power to do any acts that may be necessary or proper for any purpose in connection and support of maintenance of my wife, my dependents, and me. Wife, dependents, and me. So if there are no dependents, can Frank still not be maintained? Can his agent, when he's lying riddled with Lewy body dementia in a memory care unit in Naples, Florida, is his agent unable to provide for him because his wife is deceased? Is he unable to provide for him if one of his children is deceased? Of course not. It's the grant of an affirmative power is you get A, you get B, you get C. And if C falls by the wayside, if, as in this case, Jane still died, that does not mean that Frank still cannot be cared for under a power of attorney. So there is no question that there is authority in this power of attorney to do what Mrs. Lemon did.
Can I ask you about the IRA? The language in the durable power of attorney is very broad and on the face of it would seem to, absent the statute, would seem to allow what she did. But it does not specifically say that she can change a beneficiary. And the statute indicates that has to be done with specificity, notwithstanding a broad grant of power. So is that a problem for you? And if not, why not?
I honestly, Justice McCullough, I think that the IRA, as we said to the trial court below, is, of all the arguments, that's the closest one to having any merit that was raised. But I do believe that there was a specific grant of authority, because none other than Frank Still himself characterized that power as a specific grant of power. It is in Article 3, Section M, regarding qualified retirement plans. And note that Article 3 is, in Frank's own words, specific power relating to property. And you go to M, and M says, qualified retirement plans, the power to manage qualified retirement plans and individual retirement accounts, including but not limited to the exercise of all rights, privileges, elections, and options that I have with regard to any individual retirement account. Is there any election that you can make under ERISA other than a designation of a beneficiary? I'm not aware of it. I mean, that is essentially the only flexibility you have with an individual retirement account. If that's not a specific grant of authority, then there is no specific grant of authority.
Now, for example, the Act talks about, for powers of attorney, broad grants don't include the power to make an inter vivos trust. Well, that is specifically mentioned in here.
Yes, sir.
But in contrast, it doesn't specifically, in so many words, say that there is a power to change the beneficiary, and so that was what I was struggling with. And also the opening sentence says the power to manage. Is that different from when you're managing something as opposed to you're giving it away to somebody else? Does that, or deciding who gets it, is that different?
Well, I understand what you're saying, and managing, sort of like a money manager might manage your accounts or your IRA accounts. But the opening of Article 3 starts with this. It says, my attorney, in fact, may exercise the following powers related to my property or interest in property, which I now own or may hereafter acquire. And then you go to gifts. Oh, excuse me. Then you go to the retirement plan portion. The exercise of all rights. I'm not sure. It does say the power to manage, but the power to manage is including but not limited to this one. The exercise of all rights. So I think that goes outside of manage. And that says if there's a right that I have under ERISA that I could exercise if I were not incapacitated, then you, my agent, you have that right. And you can exercise that. And clearly, one of those would be designating a beneficiary. What if the beneficiary were deceased that Frank had named? And Frank was incapacitated. Does the agent not have the ability to make a decision in Frank's best interest in keeping with his estate plan? There's no question but that he does. At least that's our view. I don't think that we need to get to the exculpatory language because of the clear grant of authority, but there is clearly exculpatory language in 64.2.16.13 that says, absent dishonesty or improper motive, and elsewhere in the power of attorney, reckless indifference to the purposes of the power of attorney or contrary to the best interest or the reasonable expectations of the principal, then in that instance, power is going to be right. Mrs. Lemon could have been mistaken about what Frank Still's estate plan was, and there would be no summary judgment in favor of Mr. Reining. But there was much, much more before the trial court than just this power of attorney. And that has been, there was no mention of that. Hardly any mention of it in the briefs and no mention of it here today. The facts that Mr. Reining put before the court, let the court consider, urged the court to consider for 40-some days before the court held a hearing on this subject, included interrogatory responses under oath, responses to requests for admissions. All of those were exhibits. They're in the appendix in the 420 to 478 range in the appendix. And all of those were requested by Mr. Reinick to be considered in connection with what we believe, mistakenly thought, the power of under the power of attorney showed. That would illustrate that Mrs. Lemon had exceeded the power. But in fact, the opposite was true. The trial judge had the context. The trial judge knew all that Mrs. Lemon had discussed this with her father, that she had she knew of the 91 trusts that were executed mirror image, 60-40 at that time. In 99, they did it again, 55-45. They did it in lockstep. The estate plan included directives, powers of attorney, two trusts. Mr. Reinick wants to focus on freezing the testator's intent at a point in time in 1999 when his client, who is really nothing more than a contingent beneficiary of a revocable trust, he's never been anything other than that until he became the curator, and he didn't have standing as a contingent beneficiary of a revocable trust, and that's why he came back and made another run at it to become the curator. But all of that information was available to the trial court and was urged to be considered by the trial court, and the trial court did consider it. And we've all been in trials. You cannot reasonably expect a trial court to look at this part of an interrogatory answer in support of your, we believe, mistaken position that the authority was not there, and then be surprised that the trial court considered all of your exhibits. Rule 320 allows the trial court to consider whatever litigants put in front of the trial court. And this litigant put sworn discovery responses, interrogatory answers, responses to admissions in front of the trial court that made it crystal clear what the agent believed her father's intent was.
May I interrupt you before you run out of time? How is it possible to get the fees from the first litigation? There was no claim for fees. Obviously, there are a couple rules that were blown off. There's a final judgment. The case is over. It is, in fact, a separate proceeding. I'm not understanding that part of your fee request.
The case, when the case was filed, it was filed by Mr. Reinick. He was a contingent beneficiary of a revocable trust. He claimed that Mrs. Lemon did not have authority under a power of attorney.
Let's assume that all that's right, and if you had made a request for fees, you would have clearly gotten fees, but you didn't.
It was what matters now is that we did request fees in the continuation of that proceeding. The statute that's before us.
Can I interrupt again?
Yes.
It was a different civil action, though, right? It was a different proceeding. There was a final judgment. Am I wrong?
Well, I would respectfully say there's a distinction with a difference here. It was a different case number. That is true. But when you seek the identical civil relief and the identical monetary remedies for yourself personally, and then you're told by the trial judge, you don't have standing to do that. I don't have standing because I'm a contingent beneficiary. And you go and say, aha, I'm going to go qualify as the curator because a curator does have standing. Curator then is his, that's his ticket to get back into this proceeding.
What I don't understand is why didn't you ask for fees in the first litigation?
Because
your position all along was you don't have standing and you won.
It was not clear in the first litigation, as it became clear when the litigation became vexatious, that it was the litigation involving the administration of a trust. When it became clear that that was litigation involving the administration of a trust, I think that we would have asked for the fees had it not been abated on a motion for abatement because he lacked standing. But when you add that with the appeal of that and the identical relief cut and pasted into the curator litigation, what you have is what the trial judge saw. This is a serial, incessant, repeated effort to get money for the curator's personal benefit. And in that instance, that makes it a proceeding involving the administration of a trust. There was never any question that it was Mrs. Lemon's rewriting of the living trust to correct the wrong that Jane had perpetrated on her husband, who was incapacitated in 2008. There was no question that that's what she did. She consulted lawyers in Florida to do that. That was one continuous legal effort. Case, action,
but generally speaking, courts don't award fees on prior cases, even if the prior cases come and go and they're in a series of abusive cases.
There is a statute, however, and we have the benefit of that statute, 795, and it says that the court may award fees as justice and equity may require. This court was aware that Mrs. Lemon had exhausted her entire inheritance defending these repeated assaults on her actions in the administration of that trust. And the court thought it is inappropriate for the appellant to have the benefit of its full inheritance. 100% of Jane's inheritance went to the appellant, and they want 55% of Frank's trust. They've paid no fees because they had a contingent fee agreement. Mrs. Lemon has exhausted her fees.
Justice Casey, has he answered your question? Help me with the limitation of 795 to a party. Their argument is he is the curator. He is not, in the sense of this statute, another party. How do you get the fees even in the case that's before us under that statute?
I believe that it's an easy call on that. And the reason is because, for example, in Clare versus Grasty, this court said that a personal representative cannot pursue litigation in his self-interest and not pay the fees personally.
Not pay his own fees personally. You want us to extend that now to paying the other parties.
I think it comes, which side of the V the executor is on depends on who initiates the litigation. But in either case, someone claiming to be an executor or a personal representative is claiming to represent the estate. But this court has made clear in Shockett versus Silverman is a really great case, 209 Virginia. She claimed she was not a party, the executor. the executrix, claimed that she was not a party. And the court said that you must pay the fees personally because you're pursuing litigation of one legatee over another, and that's an inappropriate thing to do as a fiduciary. And we're not going to charge the people who should benefit from the estate with your fees performing an act that's not for the benefit of the estate. There is no doubt, none, that the effort being pursued by William Reinick was for William Reinick's personal benefit. It was for monetary amounts and legal remedies that were identical across the entire proceeding. And Judge Newman saw that. And he saw that Mrs. Lemon had exhausted her fees. And he's not going to allow Mr. Reinick to hide behind a status-producing title of curator that just allowed him to come back into court and have standing when he didn't have standing, not as the curator.
All right, your time has expired. The court will be in recess and will resume its hearing at 25 minutes till noon.
All right.